I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source in what feels like an Edmund Burke moment in American politics, and not the first time. Our guest is Burke's biographer, David Bromwich, who is the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. Edmund Burke is cast most often as the proto-conservative in modern times, but he's broader than that. He must be the most admired, most quoted English politician in America from our 18th century beginnings, at least until Winston Churchill and World War II. As writer and politician, Burke had befriended the American Revolution. He despised the French Revolution for its mob rule and regicide. In the 20th century Cold War, Burke was revived as the scourge of Bolshevism. But during our Iraq War, Burke was remembered anew for his scathing prosecution of British imperial crimes against India. David Bromwich, you make Burke the greatest political writer in the language, an artist of humanity at the level of Shakespeare, and emphatically a man for these times. I wonder, what would it mean for all of us to wake up tomorrow with a Burkean view of our country and of our place in the world?
Well, it would mean you wouldn't think it's a great thing to be looking forward to the next version of the computer program you like so much and hoping that it comes in 1 week instead of 2 weeks. You would be thinking, how shall I plant those apricot trees so as to make them last for my children and my children's children? There's a solid continuity between past, present, and future that Burke takes for granted as a human and social good, and not sort of the busy, stimulated sense of having always something to do and going from moment to moment. So, I mean, the modern, the contemporary way of judging a life to be good is completely at variance with what Burke cares for.
So, just what is it that defines the conservative in all of that? I mean, it sounds unreal. We'd have to give up our iPhones and all our technology, but what's the essence of what he's conserving?
Well, you're preserving, and I like to think of him, I suppose, as a conservationist of manners and morals, more than a conservative, which has a rather flat political residence, at least in America. You're conserving a heritage and a practice of ways of treating people, ways of approaching duties and obligations in life, which may seem to you so implicit that it shouldn't need repeating and is hard even to form into words. But, I mean, a habit, for example, so implicit, so tacit as the way a young man is taught to open the door for a woman, to let her go in first. That kind of gentleness is the sort of thing that has no purpose. It's reasonless, but it's part of our idea of virtuous, of decent human action. And Burke's for holding on to those things even when a value can't be assigned to them, even when the exact utility that they bear is hard to ascertain.
Let's distinguish between left Burke and right Burke. I mean, I grew up reading William F. Buckley celebrating Burke as a terrific authority of really the old ways. He took him as an anti-New Dealer, an anti, in certain ways, anti-egalitarian bulwark of aristocracy in a certain way. At the same time, especially in the last 10 years, I mean, we've rediscovered Burke, the left Burke, the absolutely unrestrained critic of his own government, especially in the colonies, in the American colonies, but most particularly in his impeachment of the administration of British power in India. Reconcile those two pieces. Why didn't we know about the anti-imperial Burke or the critical empire Burke?
Well, the great force in human affairs that Burke sets himself against is excess of power. And he says on more than one occasion and more than one way, a power in whatever hands is rarely guilty of too strict limitations on itself. And the key phrase there is, in whatever hands. In a mass democracy, when you have mob rule for periods of a day, a month, a year, Burke witnessed mob rule in England in the summer of 1780 in the Gordon riots. When you have that, the people have acquired, or the people in the streets have acquired, an excess of power. It's in their hands. But it's much more common in Burke's time, he felt, for a monarch or for an oligarchy, a faction close to the court, to have too much power. And Burke is for restraining that power. So maybe that unites the left Burke, who is for restraining the power of aristocratic grandees, and the right Burke, who is for restraining the power also of the people.
I think of Burke, I mean, again, in the last 10 years, as a sort of missing voice in this country, much more missing than he was in the Buckley days, but of an entirely different sort. Ever since we became, the United States became, after the end of the Cold War, the unipolar power, the global hegemon, it's precisely that restraint on ourselves that we've missed, and we've missed it in the Burke language, but also in our own Congress, in our own media. Who's watching us? It's a dangerous feeling.
Well, that should be the meaning of the American Constitution, which is modeled on elements of the mixed constitution of Britain that Burke always defended. Power can only be checked by power. And that means that, you know, merchant, say the British East India Company, in its government of India, and Burke referred to it as a state in the disguise of a merchant, an imperium in imperio, a state within the state. A power like that can only be restrained not by its own initiative, but by something outside it. And Burke thought that should be Parliament. And one mechanism for restraint was the impeachment of the highest officer of the British East India Company. We've lost the radical conviction of the importance of restraints on power. The greatest example of that in recent American history, I suppose, was the attempted impeachment, which didn't carry all the way through to a prosecution for crimes, of Richard Nixon in the Watergate crisis of the mid-1970s. But we had a lost opportunity for that in the succession to Cheney and Bush by Barack Obama, when there were many known or almost known crimes that Obama and his Attorney General Eric Holder simply decided not to look into. And they even developed a slogan for it: we're more interested in the future than in the past. We're not going to look backwards, we're going to look forwards. Burke is the opposite of that. If you want justice, you have to care about the injustice that has been done.
Give us that alternative Burke narrative. I mean, you years ago fixed my attention on Burke's long, late campaign to impeach Warren Hastings of the East India Company. Talk about that campaign, which made indelible history, even though it didn't technically succeed.
Well, it began in Burke's coming to be aware of abuses within the company in the early 1780s, and his writing two separate committee reports talking about crimes of embezzlement, of malversation, of the wrong use of authority, of an extractionist policy of making profits out of the Indian farmers that the British East India Company had control over, and also cases of, you know, of running proxy wars in order to conquer new lands with extremely unreliable and brutal tribal chiefs and so on, somewhat anticipating our use of the warlords in Southwest Asia. And as more and more evidence came to his attention, he decided that only a public spectacle that could bring the size of the abuse to the attention of Britain would do for his purposes. And he inspired his fellows in Parliament, Sheridan, Fox, Charles, Gilbert Elliot, and others, to manage with him the impeachment of Hastings, not just as an attempt to bring one man to justice, but to use him as a symbolic target to represent the abuses of the company as a whole and bring that company under control.
Yeah, he wanted to accuse the East India Company of what he called the great disgrace of the British character in India. And that's a big charge. It implicitly extended to Indians the rights of Englishmen in their respect before the law and before the rules of human decency. I mean, this is not exactly the
rights of Englishmen, but the feeling of equality of justice before the law, equality of treatment, as an understood thing, which was not well understood because British policy, like all imperial policy, subordinated the subject people.
But it was a noble declaration, implicitly and in fact, was it not?
Noble and so exceptional that it was treated by Burke's contemporaries as an aberration. Even his friends who were with him in the campaign early on, such as Fox and Sheridan, and his so-called cousin, no relation really, but a close friend named William Burke, rather fled from Burke than sought to understand quite what he was up to. They just didn't understand that an Englishman or a British parliamentarian could care so much about a people so alien.
Well, even in our day, you wonder, is it delusional to think of treating essentially powerless people fairly? Is this an illusion that sort of keeps the game going? Testing this Edmund Burke revival with his intellectual biographer, David Bromwich, in the first of two grand volumes. Earlier today, the Republican activist and author Yuval Levin, editor of the Policy Journal National Affairs, spoke with us on the phone about his project to put the spirit and the substance of Edmund Burke into the Republican campaign to win the whole Congress this year, not least a project to temper the Tea Party tendency to sound shrill or negative or extreme. Levin said, it is not about figuring out what would Burke say about the Iraq War or gay marriage.
A more useful way to think about it, in my opinion, has to do with what Burke's disposition would have to offer our political life, and especially what excesses it might temper or correct for, because that's what Burke did so well and so often, which was to see which way the ship of state was tilting too far and move his considerable weight to the other side to balance it out. I would point very briefly to three elements of his approach to political life that I think have a lot to teach us now and could correct some of the excesses of the right and also of the left. I think what unites all three of them is humility, which is a virtue that our politics now very sorely lacks. I would say first, Burke approached the given world with gratitude first and outrage second. He was first of all grateful for the good before he was outraged at the bad. He knew the world had plenty of both, but he began by being impressed by what was working in society and wanted to build on that to address what was failing. This was very much an expression of his humility about what human beings could achieve, his sense that disorder is in some respects much easier than a working social order, so that the institutions that have worked for us over time deserve our reverence and our regard, even as we go about addressing the problems that they have. I think that basic disposition of gratitude would do us a lot of good. Second, I think Burke thought that the sorts of knowledge available to us to address social problems were more limited than what a lot of other people and a lot of his fellow Whigs thought that they might be. Even in the age of an emerging science of society, he was more impressed by the constraints on what we could know than by the expanse of what we could know. And this is very much connected to that first point. He thought that a lot of knowledge that our society had was contained within the structure of the institutions that we had, rather than available to us as technical or almost scientific knowledge that could be kind of applied to society to transform it. And that meant that we could make progress by building on the best of what we had, by channeling social knowledge that exists on the ground, rather than applying technical knowledge that exists in some concentrated form at the center. And this kind of humility about knowledge and power, I think, would do us a huge amount of good. And again, on the right and on the left, in different ways, on different subjects, in different areas, we could really benefit from it. So the third point that I would point to has to do with both of these, and it is that Burke's image of society was an image of a coherent whole, of a kind of organism that not only spanned generations, but that linked people together very profoundly, both vertically and horizontally. He paints a very powerful picture, especially in the appeal from the new to the old Whigs, of a society that starts in the family and then kind of rolls out from there through the community all the way up to the nation, through layers of social relations, rather than directly from the individual to the state. And so he thought, again, that in trying to address problems, you had to almost treat society as a living whole, to treat it like a physician would treat a patient, rather than like an engineer would treat a machine. And this, too, I think, is a stern critique of our contemporary politics in a lot of ways, because individualism, to my mind, radical individualism, is the scourge of our politics. On both the left and the right, it is the worst excesses of both. And I think Burke would really offer a very powerful corrective to that. All three of these, really, to my mind, offer correctives to our excesses in different ways, to our excessive individualism, to our excessive confidence, to our excessive anger and resentment. Politics should help us to enjoy our society. It shouldn't always be a bloody battlefield. That's what I learned from Edmund Burke, and I think everybody can stand to learn from that.
That was Yuval Levin in Washington, editor of the journal National Affairs. Yuval Levin's book is called The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left. Not so coincidentally, Congressman Paul Ryan, who was Mitt Romney's running mate 2 years ago, calls Yuval Levin the best of the young guns remaking the Republican profile. I was also struck that Yuval Levin's profile of sort of the Burke in our midst sounds sort of like the Paul Ryan that we were sold originally in the campaign of 2 years ago. I mean, the Irish Catholic sort of family guy from a traditional contracting industry in a traditional part of the country. But that veneer work, you know, rubbed off, sort of wore out. Did it not, David? I mean, and moreover, there's something very quaint about that picture that doesn't, I don't know, does it fit? Does it fit our times?
Well, let me say a word about how well it fits Burke first. I think it's a fair impression of Burke, but it more largely characterizes the Burke of Reflections on the Revolution in France of 1790, of his time of really cultivating what Yuval Levin, I think, just called a sort of reverence for society, a reverence for institutions that's modeled on the kind of tenderness that we may feel toward persons. Burke, earlier on, is much more practical-minded and, how to say it, less pious in his attitude toward things people have made for our own benefit, and society is one of those things. A great scholar of Burke, and indeed of the whole of 18th and 19th century British history, Eli Halevi, characterized Burke by speaking once of his half-mystical, half-utilitarian way of approaching politics. And I think what Yuval Levin just addressed was the half-mystical side. But, you know, the idea that society is worked up from concentric circles that begin with the family, go out to the somewhat larger community, and thence to the nation, and finally to something more international, is not quite an accurate picture of the Burke you encounter in his writings on the American War in the 1770s and on Ireland and on economic reform in the early 1780s. I mean, I just have a little selection of Burke here, and I turned to a passage as I was hearing what Yuval Levin said, in which Burke says about his attitude toward free trade with Ireland and about making concessions to the Americans so as to end the war early. I was an Irishman in the Irish business just as much as I was an American when, on the same principles, I wished you, Parliament, to concede to America at a time when she prayed concession at our feet, just as much as I was an American when I wished Parliament to offer terms in victory and not to wait the well-chosen hour of defeat, and so on. So there he is, as it were, changing persons and finding that his sympathies and his practice of a sort of moral prudence in politics can be transferred from one idea of society to, indeed, an idea of a different society. That's not working up from the little platoon we belong to in our society to the those larger social entities. It really is an act of imagination, and Burke speaks for that, too. So it's certainly true that he asks us to temper all of our first impulses toward radical reform. But Burke was himself a radical reformer in his actions toward the East India Company, which I was speaking of before we stopped. I mean, he wanted to revoke the charter of that company as it was understood and place it under control of two committees in Parliament.
Let's come back to the East India issue and the impeachment of Warren Hastings in a moment. But Michael Lind is on the phone from Washington, and I want him to join the conversation about 2014 politics in this country. Michael Lind, fifth-generation Texan writer and commentator, long a Republican and a sort of paleo-conservative of the William F. Buckley School. But is it fair to say, Michael, in flight now from neoconservatism? Michael Lind wrote the book, Up From Conservatism, Why the Right is Wrong for America. Make what you will, Michael Lind, of this effort to fit Edmund Burke into the 2014 conversation on the Republican side.
Well, I think the mid-20th century conservatives, such as Russell Kirk and William F. Buckley Jr., would welcome a revival of the Burke who saw politics as something gradualist and evolutionary. Unfortunately, today's right does not believe in political evolution any more than many of its constituents believe in biological evolution. The animating narrative of the Tea Party right is very similar to that of the French Jacobins, whom Burke criticized in his reflections on the revolution in France. Their idea is that we had a revolution in which abstract principles of political justice were realized in a perfect form, in a timeless and eternal form for all time, and this has been betrayed by traitors to the Republic, beginning with Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, and therefore we don't need simply traditional conservative reform, which is pruning a branch here and watering a branch there. We need to pull up everything that has been done, if not from the New Deal and the Great Society, maybe all the way back to the Progressive Era, and have a counter-revolution. That's the animating idea behind the radical right's so-called constitutional conservatism. And the irony is, it's exactly the kind of mobocracy and its appeals to the virtue of the people and radicalism in the idea that there's this perfect blueprint for governance which needs to be imposed at all costs that Burke himself criticized.
So there's a huge temperamental gap between the spirit of Burke and the spirit of the Tea Party, say. I mean, the Tea Party, you could argue, is a lot more like Burke's adversary Thomas Paine.
Well, that's exactly right, because it was Paine who wanted immediately everywhere to abolish monarchy and religion and aristocracy, alienating even some of his former allies like Alexander Hamilton and George Washington and John Adams in the United States.
You're going to start the world over again.
Exactly. The very term Tea Party is a reference to the American Revolution rather than to what the Burkean conservative saw as the American evolution of liberal democracy from British precedents.
So what's the fit here in this moment, David Bromwich? Or is there one? I mean, is this an illusion?
Yeah, it's hard to make the fit every way around. As for the Tea Party, it's certainly true that some of them talk about the country having been betrayed almost from the beginning, and they want to turn back progress. And Burke was not, in almost any respect, anti-progressive or indeed anti-enlightenment in that sense. But I would make a reservation for the element in the Tea Party, as I understand it, which is deeply troubled by something large impersonal, anonymous, and unaccountable, above accountability, that strikes them in their experience of bureaucracy, and that might strike you, for instance, in looking at whether it's George Bush's No Child Left Behind program for an overall testing regime in the schools, or Obama's successor to it, which isn't that much different, which is called, I think, Race to the Top. The troubled feeling I think they might have about large institutions that no longer meet the needs of persons in communities that they can understand, that seems a different sort of objection. And, you know, there is something isolationist in a lot of the Tea Party. It's hard to make sense of it, I think, as a whole, but I'm thinking of, some of the statements you hear, at least from, say, Rand Paul, and certainly before him, his father, Ron Paul. But, you know, as for world revolution and taking the American way of life abroad by force, if necessary, the real successors of the Jacobins in that line are the neoconservatives, who, if we're going to make these distinctions about contemporary politics, don't seem to me identical with the Tea Party.
Well, let's come back to Burke looking abroad and the East India Company and the impeachment of Warren Hastings. But back a moment to our own foreign policy. I mean, talking with Yuval Levin, it was striking that he didn't want to talk about foreign policy advice from Burke in today's world, although it seems to me, it leaps out at me anyway, that Edmund Burke's record in the 18th century says he would have been just as eager to prosecute the higher-ups for Abu Ghraib, and he would have made a direct connection between an American imperial war in Iraq and the curtailment of liberties at home under the Patriot Act and Homeland Security.
Yes, he would associate those enterprises with greed and selfishness and a savage sort of aggrandizement of the powerful over the less powerful, things he always hated in every realm.
And a failure to see the humanity abroad or in a different complexion. I mean, all of the fundamental things. Could anybody, including Yuval Levin, market that Burke to our Tea Party, to our right-wing Republicans?
I don't know. I mean, you would have to think about how receptive the Tea Party has or has not been to, for example, the revelations about probably illegal and overreaching actions by the American government, revelations put forward by Edward Snowden. Some members of the Tea Party have, or people who in conversation with the Tea Party seem interested in that and to regard him as starting a discussion Americans have if we are to concern ourselves with the improvement of liberty. I mean, what you were saying about how Burke could be applied to contemporary American adventures abroad reminded me of a sentence from his speech on Fox's East India Bill of 1783, where he said that it's an arduous thing to plead against abuses of a power which originates from your own country.
Yes.
And affects those whom we are used to consider as strangers.
This now is Martin Luther King in Vietnam again.
Yeah, it's remarkable and it's stirring. And I can't say that there is someone called a liberal or a conservative in our own time who meets that high standard of wanting to remedy, in however radical a way is necessary, abuses that originate in our own country and affect those whom we are used to consider as strangers. Think how we Americans talk about American casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have no notion of the numbers of Afghan and Iraqis dead. We just don't talk about it. Burke was for talking about that.
Mm. Michael Lind, can you make a connection briefly before the break with Burke on American foreign policy?
Well, I think I agree with everything Professor Bromwich has said. If you look at tone and temperament, President Obama is much more Burkean, so to speak, than President George W. Bush, whose second inaugural address calling for a democratic revolution and a political millennium everywhere was exactly the sort of one-size-fits-all crusading rhetoric that Burke was horrified by in the case of the Jacobins during the French Revolution. I think a criticism that could be made of Burke, even in his own time, is that he wanted institutions like the monarchy and aristocracy and empire, but he criticized the violence and the treachery and the greed associated with them. And so there's a case to be made for Thomas Paine's criticism of Burke, that if you want to be the global hegemon, but you don't want torture and you don't want a police state and you don't want surveillance, you know, it's kind of difficult to do this in a nice, legitimate, lawful way.
The subject is Edmund Burke, giant of English letters in the 18th century, intimate friend of the greats in Samuel Johnson's literary circle, but also a major player in Parliament and the politics around the North American Wars of Independence. David Bromwich is our guest, Sterling Professor of English at Yale. He's just published the first volume of Burke's intellectual biography. Michael Lind, the Republican pundit, is also with us. Let's cut to the chase in American foreign policy today. President Obama, in the last campaign season of his career, took up the matter of U.S. leadership in the world at the U.S. Military Academy last week. Between ducking the assignments abroad and overdoing them, he has defined an Obama doctrine in four words: don't do stupid stuff, which could sound like the ultimate rough condensation of Edmund Burke. Here is the president at West Point.
Since World War II, some of our most costly mistakes came not from our restraint, but from our willingness to rush into military adventures without thinking through the consequences, without building international support and legitimacy for our action, without leveling with the American people about the sacrifices required.
So there was affirmation and caution in his summing up.
Here's my bottom line. America must always lead on the world stage. If we don't, no one else will. The military that you have joined is and always will be the backbone of that leadership. But U.S. military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
David Bromwich, does that make Barack Obama a Burkean?
Well, it has a prudential sound. Some of those words were followed by his pledge to call for a fund for partnering against terrorism with countries like Turkey, Lebanon, I've forgotten the rest, but Syria is to be the first theater of action for this partnering in counterterrorism. So, you know, there's another side to the policy too, $5 billion worth if he and John Kerry get what they want. I think that doing two things at once, one of which seems to cancel out the other, is characteristic of the practical contradictions in Obama's politics. But as far as the broad statement of a policy goes, yeah, the sort of prudence he was articulating there has a Burkean temper to it, and it's meant to slow down, to put the brakes on very slowly against the impulsiveness of people who want to wield U.S. power suddenly, rashly, with an immense theatrical effect. So, I mean, That side certainly does fit the Burkean model. What I don't think we can easily judge comparing the 18th century with the 20th is this idea that Americans have had, starting with Woodrow Wilson, that we must lead the world or nobody else will. In the largest days of delusion about the British Commonwealth that Burke and some of his contemporaries may have shared for moments, I don't think they supposed that the British led the world, because there was no idea of the world stage that compares with what we have now. Burke's strongest urgency is to let things be when you don't know quite what to do with them. And this might include letting violent conflicts that are very far away burn themselves out without interfering or hoping to reap some sort of advantage from them. So, you know, if that were the extractable meaning of what Obama said at West Point, I would say very good, lesson well learned.
But it's a very pale sort of Burkeanism. I'm still puzzled that how we let people who call themselves Burkean avoid Burke's tough strictures against abuses of imperial power and global dominance. I mean, how can the spirit of Burke today not deplore drone strikes, robot war on people that we've never met, that we've never accused, we've much less tried? That seems totally offensive to a Burkean standard.
And above all, that the legal justification has been made in secret and not published. You are killing for secret reasons people whose identity you may not even know, and the maker of the decision is never to be named. I mean, that is a definition of one aspect of totalitarianism, that sort of anonymity, that sort of unaccountability. And Burke, it's been said, and you know, I'm not the first, he's one of the background heroes of Hannah Arendt's great book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, that Burke is the first before the letter critic of totalitarianism. I mean, this is a real danger in some of the kinds of control over the world and over American society that our bureaucracy and our military talents now wield or hope to have. So, I mean, I agree with you that, and Burke says it in a couple of places, that accountability, fixing responsibility, and being willing to prosecute those who are guilty of acting wrongly, this is essential to the preservation of the constitutional liberty of a free people. And that certainly Obama has not done any more than his predecessors, and much more need for that came in the years after Cheney and Bush than we had seen ever before.
Michael Lind, what would Edmund Burke be saying about the drone war, about our military power?
Well, if you look at what connects Burke's loathing of the French revolutionary radicals, his criticism of British policy in India, and also his criticism of British imperial policy towards the American colonies, and even towards Ireland, he had a hatred and fear of arbitrary power, particularly arbitrary executive power. He saw the arbitrary executive as a sort of cancer which could grow up inside of a state and change its character for the worse. So I think if he were around today, to use a term from the late Cold War period, he would be a critic of the imperial presidency, waging wars that are technically not wars, as Professor Bronwich says, on the basis of legal findings which have been classified so that the American people and Congress are not told what the legal basis of these executive actions are.
Can I just say to both of you, what fascinates me about Burke is this moral figure, present at the creation of the British Empire, in effect, who really wants to understand how the great global power of England can be held accountable to English values and a respect for universal humanity, for the decent opinion of mankind, as Jefferson said. And it seems to me this is really our puzzle today. And I'm just speaking speculatively, but I think we all feel the United States is, in our lifetimes, going to be an overwhelmingly dominant military power in the world. We mean well, we mean generously, but we have seen in the last, you know, since Vietnam, the terrific tendency to abuse, to crimes, but also to racism and to terribly unequal casualties and this sort of thing. And I wonder, you know, in my lifetime and yours, will we ever get back to a feeling that our intentions and our actions, our effects, are moral in the world? This is, seems to me, the Burke assignment. How do we handle it?
Well, Chris, I think the trouble of mind you're confessing to isn't all that common among Americans, but it strikes you if you talk to a foreign visitor to this country, these people often have a contrast very sharp in their minds between how America has seemed from abroad, especially if they're not from Europe, and how America seems when you're in it and able to be living the way we live. America, to us at home and to visitors, with the exceptions of those who are treated with hostility for whatever reason, but they are few, America inside seems a wonderful, various, in many ways gentle, in all ways unpredictable, lively, energetic, extraordinary country. But America abroad and its use of power abroad would, you know, warrant much sharper language. And I don't know how that disparity is going to be closed, except by, you know, what they used to call consciousness raising among Americans. And I'm afraid, you know, with Barack Obama, as with his predecessors, saying we are the exceptional country, we see farther than other people, you know, we've just had another pat on the back and been told we're just misunderstood. We shouldn't do things too rashly, but on the whole, we're very much what we ought to be. Well, I think the country has to work at being exemplary from within, and that means taking care of itself from within much more than it has done. And it's foreign policy, it seems to me, that sets the conditions and limits for domestic policy to a great extent. But the people who are interested in reform in the United States, mainly Democrats, are concerned with domestic policy.
And we need we need courageous oppositionists. I mean, from the Burke charge against Warren Hastings in the impeachment proceedings, he said, and I can't help seeing, you know, Rumsfeld, Cheney, George W. Bush in the dock here, but he says, we charge the offender with nothing that does not argue a total extinction of all moral principle, that does not manifest an inveterate blackness of heart, vitiated, corrupted, gangrened to the very core. They were crimes, not against forms, but against those eternal laws of justice. I impeach him in the name of the commons of Great Britain. I impeach him in the name of the people of India. I impeach him in the name of human nature itself. I mean, in this great, expressive, wonderful, fun, as you say, David, interesting country, where are those consciousness-raising, critical, tough-minded, harsh voices?
Yeah, I quite agree that we lack them. There is too much concern with being reelected so that you can do the modicum of sort of temporizing good that belongs to the politician trying to work up a majority. Burke was an advocate of party, of the idea of party as an association of persons standing for a principle. And he was in opposition most of his life. He said once to Boswell, I think, that he was made to be in opposition. The idea that we should aspire to bipartisanship or nonpartisanship, which I'm afraid is a very soft core democratic and liberal idea these days, is completely non-Burkean. And the starting point for real opposition and the starting point for real prosecution of people who have made terrible errors that deserve to be punished, the starting point for that is not lawyers coming in as special prosecutors, but it is a party concerned with opposition. We haven't had that recently.
Did he worry about re-election?
He was, for 6 years of his career, the member for Bristol, the second city of Britain after London, Westminster. And that was a remarkably eminent position for someone to have held. And that was a contested election. But when he ran for re-election in 1780, he lost. And he lost partly because he had not satisfied the wishes of his constituents. And in the speech he made running for that election, he said that he defended the interests of his constituents against their opinions. I have defended, he says, your interests against your opinions with a constancy that became me. So you have to be willing not to be reelected in order to act on principle and do what is good in the long term and for the country as a whole.
Michael Lind, I want your take on this, but I just want one last word from Burke. He did not succeed in impeaching Warren Hastings, but he never regretted the effort. He said, let my endeavors to save the nation from that shame and guilt be my monument. the only one I'll ever have. Where's that oppositionist voice in this country?
Well, I think it's partly a structural problem. In a parliamentary democracy like Britain with a strong civil service, you can resign in protest and simply return to your seat in parliament if you leave the cabinet or, you know, continue to have a career somewhere in the civil service. In the United States, if if you're a political appointee, as most of the high-ranking civil servants are, and it's career suicide. You're ostracized if you criticize the administration in which you serve. For example, Richard Haass was a high-ranking political appointee in the George W. Bush administration, and after he quit, he said he thought that the Iraq War was a mistake, but he didn't resign in protest. He didn't say anything at the time, and now he's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. So not only are you punished if you challenge an incumbent administration from within the government itself, but if you go along with it against your best sense of what's good for the country, you may end up being promoted.
David Bromwich,
sorry.
I wonder, you know, what point what points do we have to give Edmund Burke just plain for courage? Or was it, did it just come so naturally to him that he didn't worry about the risk?
He was a man of extraordinary passions, and he controlled them to some extent. His passions went with his judgment and his judgments of conscience. He fits my idea of a great man and a great political thinker. That's not to say that every position he ever took is admirable or the best one at the time, but he's always thinking hard, and he's not concerned with the popularity, even within his party, of what he thinks ought to be done. So, I think of Burke as the greatest of British political writers and speakers, and someone who's, you know, subtlety as a moral psychologist and analyst is as rare in politics as it is in, say, the writing of great fiction.
I wonder, both of you, how do we bring, or do we need to bring, universal rights back into view somehow in a shrinking world where everybody's on Facebook anyway, but a zeal to think of the other perspective? Michael Lind, perhaps?
Oh, that's absolutely essential. One of the reasons which makes me think that the U.S. is unfitted for world leadership in the long run is the fact that President Obama, like our other leaders, insists on boasting that we're the indispensable world leader. Even if you were purely cynical and Machiavellian, you would do your best to persuade others that they are acting in their own interests and that you are brokering a concert of nations promoting the common good. Not declaring that the U.S. is unique and exceptional and that the world will fall into chaos without enlightened American leadership. So just as a prudential matter, a little more humility and attention paid to the interests and values of other countries in the world would strengthen American foreign policy.
Hmm. Humility seems to be the thematic word. Was Burke an English exceptionalist, or would he have applied that to his own country too?
His word for that kind of strength wasn't humility, but magnanimity.
Yes.
The virtue of a strong person or country that wants to do the most it can for its associates and rivals.
Thank you, David Bromwich. Thank you, Michael Lind. Thanks also to Yuval Levin. You can listen to the podcast of all of our programs on iTunes. You can continue the Burke discussion on our website at radioopensource.org, where you'll also find an amazing interactive map of 225 years of American political history. We had help from Drew Masiag, from Daniel McCarthy, and Adam Schatz. Next week, China Rising, with the New Yorker magazine's Evan Osnos. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Cornell Justy, and our engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath's our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.